I'm not sure we're ever getting to the lyrics in this set. It was supposed to be those magnificent men and their flying machines, but there's no sign of the men or the machines. Anyway, the next book we'll discuss, I could do worse than read the publisher's blurb for it. In the early morning of the 16th of October 1930, Oscar Garden taxied his tiny gypsy moth across London's Croydon Aerodrome and, with a wave of his hand to the only person there to farewell him, took off. His plan was to fly to Australia, which was sheer madness, as he only had 39 flying hours under his belt. And the people who had done it before him, you could count on the fingers of one hand. It was a genuinely great aviation achievement, as well as being absurdly brave. The book is Sundowner of the Skies, the story of Christchurch's Oscar Garden, the forgotten aviator. The author is Tauranga's Dr. Mary Garden, who lives in Australia now. She is Oscar's daughter. The book is about more than daring do. It's also about a mysterious life that crash-landed and a family curse that crossed generations. Oscar Garden's plane was called Kia Ora. Kia Ora, Mary Garden, how are you?
Really good, thank you for having me on.
Not at all. What a story this is, congratulations.
Thank you.
What is a sundowner? You explain it at the start of your book.
A sundowner is an Australian swagman who arrives unexpectedly out of nowhere and disappears the next morning. So the Sun newspaper called him that in a little article the next day. And I've got the exact words here because it's quite lovely. It's got Oscar Garden, the casual flyer, blew into Wyndham yesterday evening after his last hop on the flight from England. Kingsford Smith has dubbed himself a vagabond of the air. Garden, then, is the sundowner of the skies. The airman took Wyndham by surprise. There was no definite news there that he would arrive, and the landing ground at 3 Mile held no welcoming crowds. His arrival was not actually known until a motorist brought the news to town from the landing ground. So that sort of, his flight captured the world's, you know, imagination, because these other aviators had huge crowds to see them off and huge crowds to welcome them and a lot of support. So there was just one person to see him off. And he didn't want to be talked out of going, because he had only got 38 hours flying experience. He had only just learnt to fly. He had just got his solo licence, and being Scottish, he thought, I'm not going to waste all that money on a commercial licence. It'd be quicker and easier and cheaper if I just go and buy a second-hand plane and fly from England to Australia, and that way I'll accumulate enough hours, and at the end of it I'd have a commercial licence. So quite, you know, the way he did it was quite extraordinary, and he was like the unknown aviator, you know, and very low key. He didn't like the attention. The way he even bought the aeroplane was quite astonishing too, because I'm just trying to think of the name. The department store in London, it had an aviation department, and he, Selfridges. So up till 1936, it had its own aviation department. So he went in there and bought a second-hand plane for £450, and it had belonged to the owner of Selfridges, and the plane had actually been in a crash. So he would boast later on that he was the first person in the world to, you know, buy a second-hand plane, and traded his second-hand car in as well, because these early aviators were all out for the, you know, to be the first and the fastest. But he thought, well, he was the first to do that, so that was quite funny.
When you embarked on this book, by the way, explain why he called his plane Kia Ora.
Well, look, Kia Ora, even nowadays, I know it's used to say hello, but it actually also means good luck. And certainly back then in 1930, that's what it meant. And so he decided to call his plane Kia Ora and painted it in silver on the back because he thought he needed all the good luck.
Yeah, he certainly did. More than 25 years ago, actually, you wrote about his flying years and gave it to your father to fact-check, posted the final version to the Sydney Morning Herald. What was the message back from the newspaper?
Well, I actually wrote in that letter, I mean, there was no email then, I said, my father is, you know, still living, still alive, and we've got photos to accompany it. And the letter I got back, sorry, we don't publish fiction. And I thought, what the hell? So I sort of put it aside for years, and it was only by chance in 2005, I thought, I wonder if I have enough material.
When you finally got a brief version of your story published,
in the Australian Financial Review. A retired Air India pilot wrote to you and said, "I consider your father's solo flight from England to Australia in 1930 the single most sustained feat of courage in aviation. He had little flying experience. He did the maintenance himself and navigated with just an old-fashioned compass." And outside of combat, Mary, it's hard to argue with that appraisal. Why isn't your dad better known? Is there a statue of him at an airport somewhere?
Nowhere in New Zealand, not even a park. Well, he has himself to blame in part. There was no dramas and he was low-key. He wasn't flamboyant. He hated the publicity like the other aviators, Amy Johnson and Kingsford Smith and even Jean Button. During the research, I discovered that he was relatively famous worldwide in New Zealand and Australia, especially in the 1930s and 1940s. But then he disappeared off the radar, and that was because of him leaving Tasman Empire Airways when he didn't get the top job and cutting himself off from the world of aviation and not wanting to talk to anyone, and he cut contact with all the pilots he had trained. Mm. So in part, that was his own fault as well. And I think, you know, he was a difficult man too. I have a vague memory of a reporter walking up our driveway in Otamotai, Tauranga, and my father telling him to bugger off. So, you know, I was 8 or 9. And I think I took one of these articles to school one day, Otamotai Primary, for show and tell, and nobody was interested in it. So I wasn't even aware when I was growing up that, you know, I had a vague idea he'd been this pilot and he had this camphor laurel chest with all his flying stuff in it that we weren't allowed to touch. And he never talked to us.
I shan't go through your interesting and engrossing family history, but your great-grandfather's will back in Scotland was worth about $150 million. You had a dynasty going for a while, you Gardens.
Oh, isn't that incredible, digging all that up, like my father's grandfather.
Yeah. Just to scoot through family history, because that's what the book's for, so you can read about it. Your grandfather was largely disinherited, moved to live in Cave in Canterbury, then 16 Sarah Street, Timaru. The wife who had run away from him in Scotland brought Oscar out so she could get decent maintenance payments for the children, maybe. They lived in Pine Hill in Dunedin, then Christchurch. And young Oscar bought a cycle business in Spraydon. Yes? Okay. So he was a young man in New Zealand. Before we get to the flight, Oscar went on to become chief pilot and operations manager of Tasman Empire Airways Teal, the forerunner to Air New Zealand. His pilots were later to refer to him as the father of Air New Zealand. Left flying to do what, Mary?
He became a tomato grower. Initially a market gardener, he bought a citrus orchard up near Russell and then settled in Tauranga on the Bay of Plenty and grew tomatoes.
Never flew a plane again.
No, never flew a plane again, and he went on one trip in a plane for the rest of his life, and he became this different personality, and he never went on holidays. Mum would take us three kids down to Westport every year to have a break from him, to get away from Oscar, but he never went anywhere. He went on one, you know, air trip in that whole rest of his life, which is, 50 years, which is quite incredible.
Well, that's incredible. Let's go with the flight. Why did he do it?
Well, he had just got his solo licence and he realised that to get a commercial licence you needed 100 flying hours at £5 an hour, and he thought, well, it would be cheaper to fly to Australia. And had very little money left, but he strapped a propeller to the side and took two valves and two valve springs as spares. It's very hard for us to imagine what it was like, these early aviators in those little planes. No radio, no navigational aids, just a compass. There was an open cockpit, so they were exposed to the weather. I mean, hugely dangerous flight. And then he was landing at places where sometimes no one spoke English. And, you know, he had to find somewhere to sleep. Sometimes he slept under the wing of the plane, or sometimes he was hungry and he would motion for food. And one time they kept bringing him boiled eggs, and another time when he crashed in India, they were bringing him Bidi cigarettes. So, you know, really, really, these early aviators, I mean, it took them to the absolute limit of endurance. Well, they didn't know he was coming as well. He had the fuel planted there from vacuum oil. His fuel supplies left there. But he was just turning up at these places and doing his own maintenance and just setting off again.
You're right, they had to fly at low levels through turbulence, dust yes. storms, the darkness of tropical storms, yes. hunched up in their tiny, cramped, open cockpits. No, you're right, we don't have any idea of what that was like, and it was really dangerous.
Yes.
And most of those aviators, you said that not a lot of them survived. Hardly any of them survived from his era.
No, very few. Well, Amy Johnson died in a crash, so did Kingsford Smith, Bert Hinkler.
Yeah.
What's the famous one in America? Jean Batten survived.
Yeah, Jean Batten survived. And she's got a statue.
She's got statues. She's got more than statues. My father took her out on a date, I found out when I was researching this book. So in England, it was when he had finished his flight and they shipped Kia Ora over the Tasman to Wellington, and he had been there several months giving joy rides and then went back to England. And it was during that time he had met, you know, he met Jean Batten and took her out to see a film and gave her a peck on the cheek. And I thought, oh, I never even saw him do that once with my mother.
Oh, no.
It was funny.
He was 27. He was wearing a pair of slippers. He set off with some sandwiches. His flying instructor said he didn't have a hope in Hades. Do we think he was aware of the dangers?
No. As he said, when he got to Munich, he thought, oh, you know, what am I doing? You know, he had this little mishap in the first stop, and he thought, I must be mad.
For a man who didn't leave the house in the last 50 years, he'd been a reckless driver around Christchurch, and on one of his training flights in Kia Ora, his wingtip just missed clipping Edinburgh Castle.
And he was a bit reckless with the flying bloats too. I can't remember the exact quote, but he had three top army personnel. Do you remember? And he thought, I'm going to give these guys a bit of a fright. And I can't remember exactly what he did. But, yeah, he was very reckless and reckless driving. And I thought, that's what I found so interesting, like discovering this person that I...
Yeah.
Nothing like the father that I had, because I was so embarrassed when he would drive us round Tauranga. He'd be so slow. I'd sort of hide down, you know, behind the seat so no one from school would see me. And he would turn the key off whenever he went down a hill to save some petrol. So he was like this oddball father and much older than the fathers of all my friends. And I just felt so embarrassed about my father. He was no aviation hero to me.
You see, the story gets sadder as you go, but at the moment it's still intrepid. He got off to a bad start. Fog forced him down. It continued badly. The plane charged him when he started it up. He was banged on the head by the wing, threw himself to the ground, had to get medical attention.
And they tried to talk him out of continuing, but no, he just wouldn't give up. These early aviators were so competitive. You know, they wanted to be the first and the fastest. He wanted to be the first to fly to New Zealand.
Yeah.
His idea was, I'll get to Australia and then I'm going to fly over to New Zealand. But, of course, he couldn't do that because the plane didn't have the range to get over the Tasman. But
he had to be talked out of having a go anyway, didn't he?
Oh, I think he realised when he got to Sydney that, yeah, the plane didn't have the range. It, you know, Kingsford Smith's plane would have, but his range was what? He put in an extra fuel tank, so it gave him a range of 800 miles.
Yeah.
But I think, and Kingsford Smith left a week before my father, but he was out to break Bert Hinkler's record. And Bert Hinkler had a plane that had a range of 1,700 miles, so that's twice the range, and huge amount of support, whereas, you know, my father didn't have any support whatsoever.
Your father had no support. The report in the Sun newspaper, actually, when he took off, a light plane landed at Croydon Airport and from it stepped a young man who announced his intention of starting on a flight to Australia. He stated his name was Oscar Garden, his home was Christchurch, New Zealand. He climbed back into his machine and flew away. Aerodrome officials have no idea where he came from. It's astonishing. It's astonishing.
It's quite hilarious. And, I mean, he didn't tell his mother. And my father had gone to visit her a few weeks before and didn't mention it because he didn't want to be talked out of going. So the reporter tracked down Rebecca, his mother, and she was frantic because he wasn't wearing a hat. And I'm thinking, how would he wear a hat in an open cockpit plane? Like, it's really quite funny.
He has a myriad of adventures. He teams up with Mrs. Victor Bruce in her plane for a while as he goes south. And she deserves a book too, if not a movie. She was the pioneering aviatrix, wasn't she?
Oh, look, some of these early women, like, they didn't take any notice of what the men told them. And even Jean Batten, I think Kingsford Smith tried to talk her out of trying to break the England to Australia record. They took no notice. And I love the way that Victor Bruce, she flies the plane with a pleated skirt and pearls. And there were other two women aviatrixes who had broken the England... No, the South Africa England record. They would take ball dresses and put lipstick on and just sort of take off. They amazing, yeah. Well, Victor Bruce is quite well known. My
yes.
father isn't, and Victor Bruce actually survived. You know,
she did.
She was quite old.
At the age of 80, she test drove a Ford Capri at 110 miles an hour.
Oh, what an amazing story! Yeah, I think a book needs to be written about these women.
He crashes in the darkness in India. That was a bad mishap.
That was quite incredible because it was a long, long flight from Rangoon, 11 hours, 40 minutes, and he couldn't find the aerodrome. And, I mean, it was dark. And he was circling around in darkness, hoping he would get signals, and he ended up taking pot luck and he crashed between two trees in a ploughed field. So that was, you know, it's amazing that he wasn't hurt and amazing that he only smashed the propeller. And luckily he had a spare propeller with him, but the locals rushed in to help him, and none of them spoke English, and they waited under the wing till daylight with him, and one of them gave him a massage, and others were giving him beady cigarettes. And then at daylight, you know, there was this heavy downpour, and the field turned into a muddy bog. So it was an extraordinary experience in India. And as I mentioned in the book, I mean, Jhansi... I was in India in the 1970s and I'd gone through Jhansi, but, you know, I wasn't in the slightest bit interested in my father's story. But if I had, I mean, I could have gone and interviewed some of these people.
Yeah.
So many incredible stories we've lost because no one's paid attention to them or got interested in them.
Yeah.
So, yep.
He makes it across the Timor Sea, which scared him stiff. No life jacket or inflatable dinghy. Makes it to Australia and, as you said, comes into Wyndham Aerodrome in WA at dusk. Isn't there one bloke who happens to be there and he finds Oscar standing on a drum doing engine maintenance and asking him for a cigarette?
No, look, what happened, the Western Australian actually reported that it was only a tiny little town and the residents heard this roar ahead and they thought a plane had blown up overhead. So Stanley Brown was a pilot with Western Australian Airways. They had a twice weekly run to Perth. And he rushed out there and to his absolute surprise saw Oscar standing there on a drum doing engine maintenance, and Oscar turns around and says, you know, have you got a cigarette? Which is quite ironic because Rebecca was meanwhile telling all the press, because the press had started to become interested that, you know, her little laddie doesn't drink or smoke and there's my father saying, have you got a cigarette? And, yeah, so quite incredible.
One of the British papers observes that Oscar lived on raw vegetables and what is known as a green leafer, of which there are a large number in New Zealand. What did that mean?
I don't think my father took much notice of what he ate.
New Zealand, the land of green leafers.
Vegetarians.
That's right, land of vegetarians and green leafers. The youngest and most inexperienced and one of the first to complete a solo flight from England to Australia and the third fastest. So he came home to New Zealand and the plane was shipped home eventually. Wellington gave him the best reception of all, yeah?
Oh, amazing. But can I just say something else? One of the most important things, which I didn't realise till I wrote that article, because my father went to Wyndham and the other aviators went to Darwin, people said you can't fly over that great sandy desert to Alice Springs. You've got to go down the west coast. And he thought, no, no, I want to, you know, get the quickest and shortest route to Sydney. So he set out and flew over that great sandy desert, and no one had ever done that before. So that was a real aviation first that I didn't realise was significant until Dick Smith pointed it out. I mean, Two aviators had lost their lives the year before trying to search for Kingsford Smith when his plane had crashed in Western Australia. And that was a huge, long flight. And my father said that was the hardest section of the whole flight.
Oh.
It was like 10 hours. He foolishly had left the water in the front cockpit, so he had no access. And he said he had his head hanging out the side. He was burnt to a cinder and he had no water. So that's just an interesting aside. But some of the aviators said that was just hugely significant to make that flight. But we'll go back to Wellington.
Well, Wellington gave him a civic reception, didn't they? And the people lined the streets. So he was very famous once. Above Tyree Airfield in Dunedin, there's an explosion in the air. He lands well enough, discovers a fault in the plane that might well have happened over open sea.
Oh, that's quite extraordinary, isn't it? Because
yeah.
Jean Batten also asked about that as well with her plane, and I think there was a fault in that model of the Gypsy Moth. It's interesting that New Zealand really, really gave him a hero's welcome when he came back.
He barnstorms through New Zealand. He's an absolute celebrity. Sorry to cut a long story short, but he starts piloting flying boats across the Tasman, gets the hair burned off his head once by a lightning strike in a storm. And as you say, he gets miffed by the not getting the early top job at Air New Zealand, then Teal, never flies again, and was a terrible father. Why was he a terrible father?
So there was this very strict religious upbringing. There was the trauma of his early life, which I don't want to go into, that I discovered through digging around the Scottish archives, and no one in the family knew what had happened. We all carry pain. We all get damaged. But if you don't do something about it, you are going to inflict it on others. So this just kept building up in my father. And then in 1947, the last straw, here he was. They called him the boss and the father of Air New Zealand at Tasman Airways. Missing out on that top job, which he probably, with his personality, wouldn't have been very suitable for anyway, going off to become a tomato grower and then finding himself a father with three children. And my mother used to say, he just didn't cope being a father. He had this backlog of trauma, didn't know how to deal with it, clearly struggling with some psychological and mental issues, which I point out in the book, and physical illnesses and ailments, whatever. And there is a really significant part in the last chapter where, I mean, it was a terribly miserable time for my mother. She was wanting to leave him, and he walked into the room, and she tripped over the suitcase, and they both started laughing, and I find this so sad. And he looked at her and said, I just can't help myself.
And yet he had a strong sense of injustice and great sympathy for the downtrodden. He looked after a poor family in Tauranga. And
I think that's coming from his mother, because his mother was one of the very early Salvation Army captains.
Ah, yeah. Well, he had that about him too. You write very lyrically of family, and that last part of the book is very poignant. There's a great sunniness and a splendour with what he achieved and his life as a dashing young man, and this great sadness over what he became in his mundane, unadventurous later life. It's almost impossible to comprehend.
There was this sense that there was this injustice. Like, when my father died, I thought, well, people are going to know now, like, he's been forgotten. And there was nothing in the newspaper. So even though I was quite ambivalent, there was this sense of injustice, like, he deserves to be remembered. You know, even though he was flawed, even though he was harsh, authoritarian father and quite cruel, apart from all of that, what he did in aviation is absolutely remarkable.
Yeah.
And I think in his last few years of his life, he really regretted turning his back on aviation and felt really bitter that he'd been forgotten and missed out, and he'd see, you know, all this, these things being built for Jean Batten and other people being acknowledged. And so very sad ending of the book in many respects.
I don't know why posterity, as you say, decides to remember some people, not others. It's just the luck of the draw. It is so good that you've written this book. It's also a great read.
Thank you. Thank you.
Maybe there'll be a statue one day.
Even a park? There should be something in Otamodi with Oscar Garden's name on it.
You'd think. Anyway, there's a book with his name on it, and it's by Mary Garden. Well done, Mary. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Been a pleasure.
And the book is called Sundowner of the Skies, the story of Christchurch's Oscar Garden.